Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I am talking to Eveliza. Now, your last name, I was like, you'll have to tell me how it's pronounced because I wasn't sure which syllable took the emphasis.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. It's McElfatrick.
McElfatrick, okay. All right. Eveliza McElfatrick, thank you for
Nicely
that.
Nicely done.
Yep. So now that you've told us your name, can you tell us a bit about your background and your pathway into crop breeding?
Yeah, so I am a small-scale certified organic producer of seed and vegetables, and I grow and live in northwestern Ontario. And I came to this work motivated by a desire to spend days with nature, and also a recognition of the interconnections between the ways that we grow our food and basically do food in general and many social and environmental issues. So I grew up in a city. I grew up in Ottawa, actually, which is the capital of Canada. And we had a tiny backyard and even tinier garden in which I took pretty much no interest as a kid. Occasionally, there'd be some excitement around a giant zucchini that grew and was forgotten on the plants, but basically that's about it. I was generally more interested in being in nature on my bike, on foot, in a canoe, kind of traveling through spaces. I wasn't really into sitting around working in the garden. So kind of driven by this, sorry, Shane, I just need to let my cat out of the, I need to close the door.
That's fine.
I'm being climbed on by a cat. So one second. It's funny. I read a little, website about how to be a good podcast host. And one of our guests and one of the things was like, make sure your pets aren't going to climb all over you.
I have my my two dogs are sleeping after breakfast, so they're probably not going to bark, but you know, I don't feel like kicking them out.
Well, that's just it.
Oh, I wanted to ask a question. Do you have a core memory of like the first crop that like caught your attention? Because I've so many of the breeders that I've talked to, they have like some key experience of when they were fairly young that kind of turned their mind and like woke up their mind to the possibilities of like growing and maybe breeding crops.
Yeah, no, I did not have that at all.
Oh.
I was not. No, I really wasn't interested in gardening or, you know, I became more interested in where food came from and like food systems and some of those issues when I was in university and just getting older and more aware of the way the world worked. But I really, it didn't occur to me to start farming until after I'd graduated from university and I had spent a significant time on kind of an extended wilderness canoe expedition, which was an incredible way to kind of connect with landscapes and place and nature and wilderness and some of those systems that exist outside of built city spaces. On that trip, I kind of developed this longing to get to know a place as opposed to constantly traveling through places. And so that, coupled with like my awareness of the issues with the industrial food system, kind of made me go, oh, well, maybe farming is an interesting way to kind of meld these interests and things that are kind of calling to me, if that makes sense.
That definitely makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of how I came to it. I was fortunate enough to have some friends who were homesteaders outside of Thunder Bay, where I was kind of based at the time. And so they offered me an opportunity to live with them for a season and learn from them in exchange for helping out with what they had going on. So I did that in 2007. I spent 6 months there. And that kind of was the beginning of my journey in farming and food and seed production.
Now, you have since developed a very intimate relationship with watermelon as a crop. So where did that start for you?
Yeah, so after this time homesteading, I purchased some land nearby and started working on a market garden kind of in the area. And over that time, so I worked on that market garden for maybe 7 or 8 years. And over that time, I slowly developed gardens on my property. And variously over the years, between the two sites at this market garden where I was working and on my property, we tried to grow watermelons. And, you know, when you look at days to maturity, like in theory, it should be possible up here. But we had inconsistent success at best. And it was in 2019, I think, I first heard about landrace breeding and thought, what a great way to kind of try to adapt something that seems like it could theoretically grow here, but just doesn't thrive. And watermelon was the first thing my mind went to because it's, well, lots of reasons I can get into if you're interested.
I am interested.
Yeah, okay.
Why watermelon?
So, first of all, because I kind of had this previous relationship with it, right? Where it would sometimes it would work and it would be great. And I loved having watermelon come out of the garden. People were so excited about it because nobody expects it up here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but the fact that like we had inconsistent success made me think, as I said, like this might be a great crop to work with landrace breeding, and that landrace breeding might just be what it needs to be able to thrive here. Also, watermelon has the benefit of having mature seed at the same time that you want to be eating it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really convenient and enjoyable. And also you don't have to cook it. So it's just really easy. It's cross-pollinated. It lends itself to kind of working with it this way. And then finally, I was connected. You know, I started expressing my curiosity about maybe undertaking a project like this. And I was connected with a grower in the Ottawa area who had crossed 23 varieties of watermelon the year previous and was willing to share seed with me. So all of those reasons made watermelon be the crop that I started breeding.
That definitely makes sense. And yeah, you've lined up all of the criteria that tick boxes to make a crop worth investing all of this time and energy and love and attention into, to transform it from something that's marginal that you can kind of get it to work and then push it to something which is reliable. That's definitely how I see landracing working best. It's not a magic wand. Like there's a limit to how far you can expect to push the performance of a crop. So if you start kind of halfway to where you want to get, it makes life a lot easier.
Yeah, and it makes it, what am I trying to say? It makes any sort of progress like pretty obvious pretty quickly, which is encouraging and really exciting to see and fascinating to see. I guess one other thing I would add about watermelon is that like they're a really fun crop. Like they promote joyfulness. People get excited about them. They get happy about them. And that's also just like kind of a really lovely side benefit of this crop and working with it. You know, I think I get a lot more curiosity and interest and buy into the project than I would if I was working with, say, rutabaga, you know, which just doesn't stir the same thing in people.
They're a crop that's almost perfectly made for sharing with other people. They're just so big and so fun. Though this reminds me, just a very selfish aside, when I first started doing my experimental farming up here, I grew a big variety trial of watermelons, and it was a really good year for them that year. And I had wheelbarrows after wheelbarrows after wheelbarrows of watermelons. But being the hermit that I am, I didn't really know anyone. And my small family very quickly got oversaturated with watermelon. And not wanting to waste all of this amazing produce, I was eating a whole watermelon a day, just myself, for like a month. And I gave myself gout. I gave myself gout. Like my toes got sore and swelled up from all the sugar that I was pouring into my system.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I recovered when I stopped eating that much watermelon. But yeah.
So a cautionary tale to watermelon breeders.
Yeah. Make sure you've got plenty of friends who like eating watermelon. Because I mean, yeah, I missed an opportunity there to reach out to my neighbors and community and get them involved in the process.
Yeah. And I mean, I am also sort of tendencies on hermiting myself, but we do have a little veggie stand at the end of our driveway. We're all sell produce from the garden. And at a certain point, there's an overabundance of watermelons. And so I'll put those out there too. And it's been incredible, the connections I've made with, you know, neighbors and folks who stop by and, you know, people coming and making a point of telling me that, you know, they haven't had a watermelon so great in so long, or, you know, one woman was almost moved to tears just being reminded of this taste that she said, you know, she hadn't tasted anything like that since she was a kid. Some folks save seeds and just on their own accord and bring them back to me and pop them into the little mailbox where people put payments. So I'll open that up and find seeds that folks had saved for melons that they really liked. So it's, yeah, it's a really neat way. It's been a really neat way to connect with people.
So tell me a little bit about how you manage your own watermelon crop, because I'm not familiar with how it's done in such a marginal climate.
Well, I start the plants inside, usually about a month before I'm going to plant them out. And I grow them under black silage plastic, so like a thick black tarp, and I'll lay drip irrigation under there. So in terms of like kind of setup, they're a little bit more demanding than most things that I like to grow. But this works really well in keeping the weeds down and keeping them kind of off the soil and helping to kind of prevent some disease stuff. And also the black plastic has the benefit of heating up the soil in the spring and keeping it warm, which can be a challenging thing because our seasons are short. They typically have about 90 frost-free days I can count on. So, you know, in theory, it's enough, but they're not all warm days. We have pretty cool nights most of the time. So that's kind of the setup that I use and other growers that have been working on this project in this area typically use.
How big a area or population of plants do you try to grow? Because watermelons are large plants. That's probably the main downside of them as a starting breeding crop, because you do need to have a large space for each plant.
Yeah, you need a fair bit of space. So I typically aim to plant out 75 to 100 plants each year. So that takes, I actually don't know the 25 feet by about 75 to 100 feet.
Yeah.
Is the amount of space I give them. And even though I'm in Canada, for, you know, feet is how I think of the garden for some reason.
That's okay. That's okay. No, I've got a picture.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any crop, because I'm working on like starting to build crop breeding community networks here, and I'm trying to figure out which crops tick all the boxes in terms of being easy to save the seed at a time when it's easy to select the quality that you care about, and they don't take up too much space or time. And I'm thinking probably tomatoes are the most popular home vegetable for this reason, that they've got that one criteria above watermelons that they don't take up as much room.
That's true. I would also say peppers.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
Because they cross even more readily, in my understanding, than tomatoes do. And they don't even need, you know, the same sort of trellising or support that tomatoes would need.
And you can get a longer season out of them too, which I think makes them better for a home garden. Let me think. So what are your priorities in watermelon breeding?
So basically the goal is just to try to develop a population or support a population of watermelons that thrive in our marginal growing place. And so we've been selecting for early ripening and great taste. And that's about it so far. So typically saving seed from the 25 first ripe melons that we get each year, that also tastes great.
I'm just trying to think. I had a question. Where did it go? Oh, is early vigor really important? Like, do you sow large amounts of seed and then thin to the ones that start vegetatively filling out the fastest?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So yes, I guess, but not initially, like not by design. One thing that we've run into over the last few years is actually seed that germinates really well from plants that matured early and tasted great, but that are very low vigor. And as best we can understand, this is a function of seed maturing when overnight temperatures and just temperatures in general are cooler than they need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess, yes, we are selecting for early vigor, but we're not necessarily able to select for vigorous vigor.
Yeah.
We're
yeah,
selecting for more than just terrible vigor or no vigor. Yeah.
It's tricky when you're balancing multiple traits. Sometimes you can over-select for one trait, and then that means that you go backwards on another trait. So yeah, it's a balancing act. Any thoughts about storage of ripe fruit? Because I know there's some strains of watermelon that you can pick and then you don't have to eat them in a hurry, whereas other ones, the quality of the fruit very quickly degrades. And particularly being in a cooler climate, that could actually be an advantage, that the crop remains edible, high quality for like maybe a month or two in the cooler weather.
Yeah, I love the idea of like a storage watermelon. Initially, my focus in the garden was on producing like root and storage crops, mm-hmm. because our winters are so long and we have such a long period of time where there's not fresh stuff coming out of the garden. We did have one farm site that is working on this project. They actually forgot a watermelon on top of their fridge last year until March when they found it. Mm. So 6 months later, and pulled it down and brought it to us like a seed swap presentation we were doing.
Mm.
And we cut it open there and it was okay. Mm. It wasn't great. I mean, it was kind of dehydrated, but it hadn't rotten. It hadn't rotted, which was really interesting. So yes, I love the idea of a storage or like a longer storing watermelon, but I feel like before I'm going to start selecting for that, we just need to get through this.
Yeah. 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 Totally.
Seed vigor kind of challenge, which I feel like is the biggest challenge at this point.
Do you think when you got to that phase of trying to incorporate storage as well as like eating quality after it's stored, would you try and bring in new genetics of strains that are reputed to have good storage to like kind of restart that process? Or would you just start selecting storage from the pre-existing diverse population?
I think I'd bring in new genetics. I think I'd try to find out what varieties were out there that had that trait and try to introduce that into the population. I think that would be interesting way to do it, first of all, because at least you'd get that first season of seeing those individual plants, right? Mm. And those individual varieties and how they did. And yeah.
Because do you know about jam melons, the citron melons? I grow them here sometimes because they're incredibly vigorous compared to watermelons. They're like a more ancestral. And they store for like a year. You can just leave them lying around. And that's in our warm, humid conditions. And under cool root cellar conditions, they probably last multiple years.
Yes. Actually, even the folks that I initially homesteaded with, they used to grow citron melons too. Mm. And I think citron was part of the original cross of 23 varieties, if I'm not confused. Mm. But I'm pretty sure that it was. Yeah, citron is interesting. I just don't love that they don't taste as good.
Yeah. You have to add sugar and other fruit to them to really do anything. This is a really radical suggestion, just way out there. Have you heard of mentor grafting?
No.
So it's a technique where you take a rootstock that's usually fairly mature and under the ideal conditions, and you graft another plant on the top of it. And it needs to be a seedling and preferably a recently hybridized line of seedlings for the scion on top. And if you remove the leaves from the scion for the first phase of its growth, it seems to encourage heritable genetic elements to move from the rootstock into the scion.
Oh, wow.
The Chinese have been doing this for a long time, and it's been confirmed that there are genes that are moving this way. So you could potentially try using a citron rootstock with diverse watermelon scions and then start selecting for storage, and you might actually get that trait coming through without losing any of your fruit quality. Because like if you do a 50-50 citron watermelon cross, you're going to go so far back on fruit quality in the early generations. But yeah, it's a more speculative way of doing it, but you might even have benefits if the citron rootstock has extra vigor.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yes, definitely the vigor piece of things, I think, because they seem so much hardier than watermelons.
Yeah, you could get all sorts of vigorous elements coming through without having to give up half of your fruit quality genes in the first
Yeah.
genetics and then spending multiple generations trying to get it back. I don't know, it's a lot of fiddly work grafting cucurbit seedlings, but I mean they mass do it. They do it industrially. So there are pretty well laid out techniques for that. So I don't know, just throwing an idea out there, you could lead to something
Yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just fascinating the different ways we've learned to work with plants.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah,
Yeah.
there are so many odd approaches that are in the margins that don't get a lot of light shine on them. So that's why I'm always dropping those in just as things to consider, not just for you, but for the whole audience. So let me think. So we're mostly focusing on watermelon. Doubtless that you have other crops that you work on as well, but because you've done such interesting stuff with the watermelon that we'll get to soon, I want to focus on that. Have you ever done hand pollination, or is it always just open mass pollination?
With the watermelons, it's always just been, actually, I think on the whole, yes, I don't think I've ever hand pollinated anything, actually. It's always just been mass pollination. And partly because that's like one of the things about land-raised breeding that appeals to me so much. Like it's more hands-off, which frees up time. But also, I just love this idea that in kind of planting various populations and allowing them to cross, we're just giving the plants the space to do what they need to do to thrive and kind of just staying out of the way and trusting that they're going to sort it out. And like, we'll support them, we'll give them the happiest place that we can to grow and respond to their needs as possible. But in terms of the breeding, like, that's really their expertise.
It makes you wonder how much the bees read them and how much they're conscious. Because I know I've seen studies that particular bees in the hive have particular crops that they specialize in. They don't just go from one random flower to one random flower. They've got a lot going on in their little heads, and I wonder if they're like, even if the bee is like, oh, I like watermelon flowers,
Yeah.
they might have particular tastes of watermelon flowers that bias the pollination in interesting directions.
Yeah, it's true. I said I'm letting, like, we let the plants do their thing, and they do. But also, yes, for sure, the pollinators are in there and influencing things. I just don't feel like I have any particular expertise to know to influence one way or another. And I just really like seeing what comes out of this process.
There's a lot to say for serendipity in this whole field, and just keeping an eye out for those random miracles that drop out of the process. I think
Yeah.
it makes the whole growing process more exciting.
Yeah, and I mean these things happen. One of the well the fellow I got the initial seed from, he talks, I love hearing him talk about the mango melon that he found in his F1 population. He, had hundreds of watermelons, as you can, relate to, and was tasting them on a regular basis. I think he said he had this schedule where he'd taste them every 2 hours, he'd try a new watermelon. And, weeks into this, he tasted a watermelon that had the color and the flavor and even like a denser, creamier texture like mango. And he couldn't believe it, basically. He talks about it as being, something that not even a super advanced magician could do, but it was just this gift. And he, took the time to taste all the melons and to find it and became completely enamored with it. And so were the mice, and they ate all of the seeds he'd saved, basically. And so, here we are 5 years later, and he's still looking for the mango melon. And, now there's multiple areas and sites where this, his population has been grown out for several generations, but we've all still got our eyes out for the mango melon.
Well,
Yeah.
that gets me onto my favorite question that I like throwing at my guests. If you could like wave a magic wand and create a crop, like if you didn't have to, I mean, pick something that would take thousands of years if you want. What would you kind of like wish into existence if you could create any crop?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a fun question. But
What about
yeah.
any wild species that haven't really been domesticated that you think have potential?
I mean, I think I just come back to the same idea that I feel like I just want to see what nature can do, basically, and what happens out there. And I feel like any sort of, I'd love a, oh, I don't know, anything that's, even slightly realistic that I could come up with, I think is boring in comparison, probably, to what possibilities are out there.
It's like the saying, truth is stranger than fiction, that it's more like reality is more interesting than fantasy.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good way to put what I'm trying to say, because I would love a, I would love to be able to grow pineapple here, but I mean, that's never gonna happen. But I love that.
If you're really ambitious, there are cold hardy bromeliads and there's other edible bromeliads, and the whole family splits in two, and pretty much everything on the pineapple side they can intergenerically hybridize with each other. So it's not impossible, but yeah. You'd probably need a
Well, that's
great
like,
you'd probably need a heated greenhouse to like get the first generation started. But yeah, I think it's another one of these families where there's so much genetic richness in it, and there's just one that historically got turned into a fruit. So yeah, never say never.
which, yeah, I guess, and which is a great lesson, right? Because there is just so much, there's so much more diversity out there than I think we realize. There's, and yeah, I just love that the possibilities exist. And I guess maybe more, I just want to try to make room to explore those more.
This gets me onto a related thought. I've started thinking that there's only one fully domesticated plant in the world, and I would say that's corn, because it's so dramatically transformed and it's so dependent on humans now. Whereas watermelons, they're in a relationship with humans, but under the right conditions, they're quite capable of abandoning us and going back to being, doing their own thing. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, I'm curious that you think that. Like, I don't think that there's, is there any chance that a watermelon could just rewild its, I mean, maybe in the areas that it comes from? Is that what you're thinking?
I'm sure somewhere in like Alabama, I've heard of people saying that along the rivers there used to be feral watermelons that were still quite good to eat.
Watermelons. And I actually did just hear about wild squash up in this neck of the woods, which I would not have thought is possible. So, I mean, I love that idea that these crops can rewild themselves. That seems so, I don't know, it seems hopeful to me.
Well, I mean, some land races are working in that direction. You gradually reduce the amount of inputs and management through the breeding and selection process, and it's remarkable how far you can push things if you're in the right location for that particular crop.
Right, like if you're in a place that didn't start off being super marginal to begin with. Yeah, sorry, I got this. What was your initial question
Oh, just the
about this?
idea
I just got lost in the thought.
that corn is probably the only fully domesticated crop that like all the other ones are kind of part way through that journey, and that they can go back to being wild if they really wanted to. Corn's the only one I can think that would have almost no hope of rewilding itself.
Do you think, I mean, there's so many different varieties of corn. Do you think none of them would?
I think the size of the seed, the lack of the seed coat, and the husk around them means that they're basically all in with humanity. Whereas you get
Yeah.
like wheat and rice, they go feral all the time. You get volunteers when you try and change from one crop to another.
Yeah. That's interesting. Have you read Robin Wall Kimmerer's essay about corn?
No, I will make a note and I will track that down.
No, it's beautiful. I won't try to paraphrase it because I won't do it well, but she talks about how we are corn people, basically, right? Like we have fully, as you're saying, like really transformed corn, but corn has also really transformed us.
Just so out of interest, there's an article I saw recently which blew my mind, which people in this field need to know more about. They trace the genetic ancestry of corn. So the original domestication was a hybrid of two wild species, including teosinte. And that stayed in its little tiny valley in Mexico for like thousands of years until a third hybridization with another wild species in the family happened. And that was the population of corn that spread everywhere. So it just goes to show the potential, like the explosive potential of wide crossing, that a crop can go from being useful but marginal to like taking over the whole planet just because of one random cross.
Yeah, it's amazing and probably like was unthinkable.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at teosinte, there's no way that you can imagine what it could become. And I don't think anyone could have set out wanting to force it to become corn. It had to be a gradual negotiation between humans and the plant over a long period of time.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, and all of the other elements, but also that attentiveness, right? To notice that cross and to work with it.
That's one thing I really wonder with industrial production. So you've got like one farmer in a huge tractor going over like an enormous field. Even if there was genetic diversity there, they'd never see it. Like it's invisible to them. So breeding of crops and producing of crops have become completely separated from each other and unresponsive to each other's needs. Whereas pre-industrially, breeding and production always happened side by side. They were inseparable.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing and seems so counterintuitive that we would set up a system where now, yeah, the seeds that are being produced, that people are growing, are produced so far away in such, in such removed of a, sorry, I'm stumbling over my words here.
No, I don't.
You can take that part out. But just to say, yeah, it's wild how the food system essentially has evolved to be so, you know, so reductionist and focused on its specific parts that the parts don't talk to each other anymore. And that isn't without consequence, right?
Yeah. The system becomes fragile and focused on really superficial metrics rather than actual quality, because nobody's tasting the food until they've already bought it. It's too late at that point to say this tastes like garbage.
Yeah. And so many, you know, I just think about the need for regionally adapted seed even, and how, you know, where I'm living, and I'm guessing probably where you live, I mean, where most people are living and growing, the seeds aren't adapted well to those regions because they're adapted to the majorly productive industrial agriculture system. It doesn't happen here in the same way. And so the system is also leaving all of these different growers out and leaving all of these different plants and seeds and diversity out of the system, which is, yeah, it makes it really fragile.
Now, that is probably a good point to move on to the part where I love talking about anyone that's building networks of breeders and growers. And you are an absolute unicorn on this front. Can you tell me about how your initial experiences of growing and sharing seeds grew into something so much more?
Yeah. So, I mean, with respect to this watermelon project, I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons I chose to work with watermelon was because I was offered and had shared with me seed from a cross that a fellow farmer named Manish had done of 23 varieties of watermelon. And Manish was happy to share his seed. He shared it with me. He shared it with many, many people. And we kind of kept in touch over the years. I grew it out. I had some marginal success. I saved some seeds. I grew it again. I had more success. And eventually, kind of in our correspondence, we thought, maybe we should kind of make this project he was still growing the watermelons too. And we thought, let's make this project maybe something more than just I'm growing these watermelons and you're growing these watermelons. So we reached out to the Ecological Farmers Association of Ontario, which is a great organization that we have here. One of the programs they run is a farmer-led research program. So we applied to basically have this watermelon breeding that we were doing become kind of more officially a breeding project through this farmer-led research program. And basically what that meant is we came up with a protocol for our research, and we invited other farmers to participate. And the EFAO helped with all of this, helped connect us with other growers, helped design sort of our research protocol. It's a three-year project, which is ending this fall. So they will kind of crunch all the numbers and evaluate all our data. And yeah, it's been really, really neat to, so ultimately it grew to five sites. There's five sites across the province where land race of watermelons is being grown out. Three are in my area up in Northern Ontario. And then there's Manish in Ottawa and another woman not far from him.
So do you want to give an overview about how, well, let's do it phase by phase. Like one thing I'm really curious is about how were the participants like recruited and located and like induced into participating? That's often a tricky stumbling point if you want to build one of these kind of projects yourself.
Totally, totally. So we were fortunate. The woman growing near Manish is a fellow seed producer and somebody that he knew. And so she's also curious about landrace breeding and was keen to get on board. And then the two other farms or producers up here working on it are folks that I knew. So one is another market gardener. And then the other is like a local, it's actually a not-for-profit organization that does a lot of work around urban agriculture and food security and food sovereignty in the area. So we kind of knew these people already, but one of the things that's wonderful about this farmer-led research project is that the EFAO will often, if needed or wanted, will put out the call to all of their members to say, does anybody want to be part of this project? And so I've been recruited to be part of other, like not breeding projects, but variety trials that way. And so they do a great job of helping bring people together.
So that's probably the first lesson. If you're thinking of building something like this, leverage pre-existing networks and connections rather than just trying to do it from scratch.
Yeah, and also watermelon is an easier sell than fava beans. Like I definitely had people say, I don't know if I would have done this if it was not watermelons.
Yeah. Okay, so the next phase in the project was setting up a protocol and distributing the material.
Yeah, and so we did that. Basically, the EFAO, they brought us all together. We had a Zoom meeting and we chatted about kind of what we wanted the goals of the project to be. Essentially, our question was, is this going to work? Is this population of watermelon going to adapt and across our various sites? And if so, how different are they going to be after 3 years of being grown at the various sites? So we came up with a protocol that would help us kind of answer that question as best we thought. And also another key thing was that we're all producers. We're all market gardeners or seed producers. And so time is tight and there's other kind of factors to consider in terms of, well, for example, if we grew 300 watermelons, I'd actually kind of need to sell some of them. So we decided on a protocol that would be really as easy as we could come up with, and also so not take a ton of time, and then also kind of free up, not require all of the fruit to be part of this process, which is how we came up with tasting and selecting seed from the first 25 ripe watermelons. So I maybe said that a bit wrong. We tasted and selected from as many of the first watermelons as we needed to until we got seed from 25.
Okay, that makes sense.
That makes sense. And we kept notes.
I think that's a really clear thing, important thing to point out, is having a clear set of goals and criteria for people joining the project, and that it would that everyone's happy with when they sign on.
Yeah, and that's pretty simple.
Mm.
That's not really, yeah, cumbersome, because even you know, I feel like we came up with the simplest protocol, and it still isn't always easy to see it through.
Mm.
Mm. Things happen. And so, yeah, we tried to keep it simple, but we also tried to keep it, you know, valuable and informative. So we saved those seeds. We also kept notes about kind of the shape, size, color of the melons that we saved seed from. And then once we were done that, the only other thing we wanted to know was just yield, overall yield from mm-hmm. year to year.
Mm. Do you have any thoughts on the size of the group doing a project like this together? Because like at one extreme, if you've got like only two people, I guess it's not quite a group yet, but if you've got 1,000 people, juggling all of the logistics becomes more and more complicated as the numbers get beyond a certain size. Do you have a gut feeling of what like the ideal size of a participatory group for a breeding project?
Yeah, it's funny, when you first asked, I thought, oh yeah, I mean, the more the merrier. But then you threw out the number of 1,000, I was like, oh yeah, that would change things completely. So yes, definitely more than two. And in some ways, the more the merrier, to a limit, I guess. Or mm. to, yeah, because one of the things that's been really lovely about this is, even though not all the growers have met each other, we've all spoken of feeling part of something bigger than ourselves, which mm-hmm. was actually a motivator for at least some of the participants, because market gardening and farming can be kind of isolating and isolated. And so this project has kind of given folks an outlet to be part of something interesting and curious and bigger that isn't so focused on just production
mm-hmm.
and sales. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be lovely to have more than the five of us doing this. And I don't think that having 10 or even 20 people engaged in the project would, yeah, I think that would just make it richer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's like an intimacy about it too. So I think maybe when the number became so big that now you just felt like a number, then you would kind of lose that sense of community and collaboration. And it would start to feel again like you're just doing something that other people are doing and nobody really.
And your contribution may not be as important, so you're less motivated to follow through.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That sense of, that's the word I'm looking for, like reliability or accountability. That's the word.
Yeah.
Gets lost.
Yeah. Was the seed pooled again at the end of each season? Because you said this went for 3 years, or did each grower direct their own population wherever it ended up?
Yeah, so the idea was for each grower to save their seed and then grow out their own population, like grow out their own seed that they had saved,
mm-hmm.
just to see if the populations would change in any, you know, would develop differently.
Yeah,
based on the different sites. Now, again, that's like where one of the, that's a simple thing to do. But then, you know, one year, maybe there's a crop failure. One year there was a crop failure at one site. And so I saved seed back.
Mm.
With them. Minish is like so all in with this stuff, and he's so energetic and has quite a lot of space to work with. So he actually has been growing this population, but then he's got enough room to isolate, and he's been growing out all sorts of other various permutations that have come out of this population. So I sent, he requested and I sent him some seed a couple years ago. So he's growing out my population separate from his population. But for the most part, we're trying to stick with just growing out our own seed for the 3 years.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to compare the process, and it would make your thesis at the end. You've got something else to dig into. But I wonder if an alternative model would be much narrower selection on each site. So rather than the best 25 melons, maybe just the best 3, and then mix and match that seeds between different sites to limit inbreeding.
Yeah, that would be, I think, a really fun way and interesting way to do it, especially if people had less space.
Mm-hmm.
If people couldn't plant out, because we're asking folks to plant 50 plants.
Yeah.
You know, if you only have room in your garden for a few, or even just, yeah.
Because, yeah, I'm trying to
together would be great.
I'm trying to develop systems that work better with home growers, And the issues of small populations and inbreeding and then throwing selection on top of it can be a problem just for one grower. But if you can mix everything up between the sides, that's a way of kind of hypercharging the selection and avoiding too much inbreeding. So yeah, you have to adapt to the exact network that you're growing in and the grower's circumstances.
I like the idea of bringing all those seeds together again and then redistributing them, because it just reaffirms kind of the collaborative nature of the project, you know, and it keeps it exciting in that the next year you still don't know what you're going to get, even if all three of the fruits you selected seed from, you know, that you contributed to the project were yellow, you might get something pink or orange the next year. I find that curiosity piece is, it's really motivating and inspiring.
Now, I had a read of your thesis and I really enjoyed it, and I've got a couple of notes on it. So there's an evolving language or worldview around how humans relate to their crops and livestock. And I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, are you talking about some of the ideas in there around like plant agency?
Yeah, and assembly theory and post-humanism.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm happy to talk about it if you think your listeners would be interested. So, I mean, maybe just to back up a tiny bit, because I'm not sure if we said this, this watermelon landrace breeding project a couple years ago became kind of the central subject of a master's thesis that I just completed. And the thesis was, thank you. The thesis was looking at the ways that seed-human relationships can support health from an eco-social perspective. So just to say, not just health of individual bodies, but health of societies and environments and ecosystems. And one of the things that kind of led me to this was this realization or this understanding. It's not a new realization on my part, but just one that, you know, I was made aware of, I guess, that when we work with seeds in kind of a landrace breeding context, what we're doing is engaging in a process of coevolution, which is to say that like the plants are changing and evolving, but so are humans, right? Mm-hmm. And this is how we domesticated plants. And we were talking about corn and, you know, this idea that we have changed through our breeding of corn and our selections that we've made, you know, and through its willingness to change, you know, corn has gotten to this place where it is pretty much utterly dependent on us. And we have also similarly gotten to a place where arguably we are fairly utterly dependent on corn. So this idea of coevolution made me think about how, you know, what I'm doing with this watermelon project, or what we're doing with this watermelon project, you know, who really is doing the breeding? And so I decided I wanted, when I was, sorry, Shane,
it's okay.
Lost in thought. I've never gotten good at explaining this, even though I feel like I should have by now. Essentially, in my thesis, I was afforded the opportunity to really dive into what we were doing with this landrace breeding project. And I got a chance to study the relationships that were kind of forged between the human and the watermelon collaborators. And what was really interesting to me and why I wanted to look at this kind of goes back to this idea of coevolution and the fact that if we accept the idea that plants are changing humans and humans are changing plants, then we have to accept the fact that plants have agency and that they're actors in this world and they're not just sort of objects that we enact our will and desires on. Which led me down this kind of academic rabbit hole to this idea, it's philosophy and a methodology of post-humanism, which essentially just tries to, or which argues that humans alone don't have agency. In fact, the idea of a human is just, you know, as we, it's a social construct.
It's like all categories, it's got a fuzzy edge.
It's got a fuzzy edge, exactly. And we kind of ignore that and just go about our days thinking that that fuzziness is not fuzzy, but it really is. And it's really problematic. And so post-human thinking challenges us to kind of accept this idea that not just humans have agency. What is a human anyways? And let's kind of get over ourselves and this idea of human exceptionalism and make room for other species and other beings to be actors and co-creators in the world we live in. So that is kind of the perspective I took for my research. And it took me a really long time to say that. And I don't remember essentially. So you were talking, yes. And so this idea of plant agency, right? That plants and animals and basically any non-human being is an actor in co-creating this world, isn't just an inanimate object. And that as such, essentially, like our world is created through the actors of all of these various actors. We're all connected in what is termed like an assemblage of beings and actors. It's webby, you know. It's like the I'm planting the watermelons and the bees are pollinating them, and the bees are pollinating other things, or maybe there's no bees because it's really cloudy. Like it's all of these parts. It's are creating our reality and are shaping what is and what can be, which is a really different way of looking at the world than kind of our more typical top-down sort of trying to control and tease apart and separate everything kind of human style.
I really love whenever I grow watermelons of thinking about how humans have just kind of stepped into the relationship that was originally between watermelons and elephants or warthogs. Like they're the species that created like, 99% of what a watermelon is. And then humans came along and started, created a new relationship with that plant and transformed it from, a jam melon-like species into a sweeter crop that suits our tastes. And the watermelon went along with that.
Yeah, it went along with that. And then we also changed to accommodate the new needs of these watermelons. Yeah, I love. And so, anyways, I just find this all quite fascinating.
I also like the idea of like post-humanism is challenging the boundaries of that category, but you can apply it to the plants themselves, like post-watermelonism, because the watermelon that we think of in a narrow sense is connected to those wild relatives. It's also connected to all of the microbial symbionts and the endophytes and, all the microbes that make that plant function, but they're always swapping in and out when you grow the crop in different locations. So there's so much more going on than just the label that we conveniently put on the seed packet.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I also, one of the things I ran into in writing this thesis, and I still run into thinking and talking about things, is like, I'm like, when is, how to say this? When is a watermelon a watermelon? And like, the difference between a seed and a watermelon is obvious when you look at the mature fruit and the seed, but that line between the two of them is also really fuzzy. Like, when is a watermelon born?
You can pick it a week early and it's nowhere near. It doesn't fulfill its potential in the relationship because you didn't behave appropriately for that crop.
And then also I just think about, yeah, it's just funny. I think about, planting a seed and what am I trying to say here? When is a seed? Okay, I just need to tell you the story here, Shane, and you
I'll
can keep
do
this out if you don't want. But what I keep going
it.
back to is like a friend of mine is an astrologer, and I had asked her at one point, could we do a reading for these watermelons? Because I
That
just
is,
love thinking about
no,
these
I love
things
that
in as
idea.
many
I love
different
that
ways as
idea.
possible.
Did you know,
Yeah, and
for reference, Newton, like the father of physics, is also often described as being the last of the magicians, that he had so many supernatural and religious beliefs and experiments that he did that kind of get swept under the rug today when we like to think of him as being rational in the modern sense, and that there is so much more to science than just, making a mathematical formula and saying the end.
I think so too. There's so many different ways to understand the world, and I'm
So
just super curious about them.
tell me about you did an astrological chart for the seeds. I want to hear about this story.
Well, we never did, but we had talked about it, and one of the hiccups we ran into, which we could have just overcome, but is that we when is again like when is the watermelon when were the watermelons born? And is it when they germinated? Is it when the fruit is set? Is it when the seed is harvested? Like where, because it's so cyclical and the boundaries, this just comes back to your, I love the way you said it, like the fuzzy boundaries around things. It's like, it's not, when you really start thinking and you really dive in and you really start looking, it's not that clear. And I just think it's really important to kind of hold that in our minds when we go about our lives in this world.
Watermelons are also a really great example of a crop with a techne, like a feel that cannot be readily put into words. And that's the technique of rapping on the melons to tap on them to tell if they're ripe. And once you understand how to do that, it's amazing. Like, and you understand how other people do it, but you couldn't just write a set of words to like send in a letter to someone and then they'd automatically know. And was that something that you had a chance to spread that knowledge to other people? Because you were doing field visits to the people who were growing in the project.
Yeah, totally. And that was one of the main questions that growers had, or like, folks involved in this project, was how do you know when a watermelon is ripe? And, different watermelons have different, my understanding of it is that different watermelons have different ways of telling you they're ripe. I would say the easiest one is the melons that have that yellow and ripe gene. They turn yellow and you know they're ripe. Some are like more likely to or inclined to kind of slip off the vine. You don't have to tug at them. But these are ground spot color is another indicator that I've heard people use. But because this population is so diverse, you can't, you just don't know. You can't rely on any of those. And so the way I found was most reliable was this knocking on the watermelons idea. And yeah, I mean, there's, like you said, it's hard to put into words, but there is a different resonance of a watermelon when it is ripe. And even I, every year, have a hard time with probably, I would say, the first 10 melons. I don't necessarily get it right. But once my ear gets kind of reattuned to listening to that sound, or listening for that sound or that vibration, then I can kind of run with it, and I start to be able to pick them out a lot better. But that was a fun thing to get to share and work with and teach some of the other growers. And there is lots of good moments, and it's kind of funny to see people with their ear up next to a watermelon in the patch, knocking on things,
Because it's not just a
People.
sound, it's the vibration too. Like
Yeah.
you have one set of fingers on the melon as you're tapping with the others.
Yeah. Yep. Totally. It's a sound, but it's also just the feel, the resonance, the. Yeah. It's like trying to talk to a watermelon.
Wonder if the seeds are inside, like waiting for that telltale tap. It's like, here we go, people.
Yeah. It's our moment. They're talking to us.
Now, I noticed in the thesis part of your model was an incentive, a money incentive for when people finish the cycle and returned the data, I think, in your case, for each year. How did that work? Like, and can you think of other ways of incentivizing people who like start on a breeding project to see it through to the end?
Yeah, so the EFAO through there, so this wasn't money that I offered through my thesis, but it was offered by the EFAO as part of the farmer-led research project. They offer farmers a stipend for engaging in research on their farm and kind of seeing the whole process through. And the idea of that, as far as I understand, is just to recognize that, often these farmers are giving up space in their production gardens for something that is a big unknown. And that work should be compensated because it's really valuable. So for my part, I didn't actually talk to the other growers about this or about the role that that stipend played, but for my part, I find it is really helpful in just giving me the freedom to say, yeah, I'm gonna take this on. You know, it alleviates, it makes it so that I don't, that space isn't competing. It's not competing, but like, I don't need to worry about if I make money off of that bed, basically, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. Because I know that income is going to be there. And so I think it works really well as, I don't know if it incentivizes anybody in that, like, it's going to convince anyone that isn't interested in this kind of stuff to take on a project like this, but it allows people to do it.
I guess it's just also an acknowledgement of the value of their contribution of choosing to participate.
Yeah. Yeah. That what you're doing on your farm, even if it isn't producing, you know, tons of market carrots, is still valuable. And we see that.
Do you have any broader thoughts on the economics of small scale breeding and seed production? Because I think you said you sell some seed as well.
I do, yeah. I grow seed on contract for other seed companies, and I've recently started selling seed through my own seed packets. I also have been growing and providing seed to like a local seed collective that I've been a part of for 10 years now, and we sell we pool our seeds and then collectively sell those in packets kind of in our community as well.
Mm-hmm.
As for the economics of it, I would say it's challenging. Yeah, I don't know. How would you like me to? I'm happy to expand on that, but I'm not sure exactly what.
Well, I mean, one thing I've found a challenge here, I've tried to do the same thing, is the pervasiveness and the convenience of the glossy packets of, you know, imported, non-locally adapted seed. Like that seems to take most of the market share, not because it's a superior product, but just because it's familiar and, you know, it's got a glossy photo on the front.
Yeah, totally. And I think so there's a lot of education I think that needs to happen to make people make that choice to buy regionally adapted or seek out regionally adapted seed versus just grabbing whatever's at the grocery store on the rack. I found for myself by growing on contract for other companies, so I'll grow larger amounts of seed, I often have, so that allows me to sell a bulk of my seed, because sometimes you need to grow, you know, for a minimum population, say of rutabaga, which I grew this year for seed, like I have more seed than I could ever sell.
Yeah
myself. So having that arrangement and those connections and relationships with other seed companies to kind of make sure that seed that gets produced does get into hands. I basically think of it as they help me get it into other hands.
Yeah.
I don't have that same customer base that they do. And then otherwise it's kind of that same game. I feel like it reminds me of, you know, trying to sell vegetables that grow well here that nobody knows at the farmer's market. It's just a lot of education and teaching people about why it matters and why this is what you have and what you're doing and, you know, how the benefits of it.
Never forget that it took like 100 years before people in Europe got around to enjoying eating potatoes. They went from like, oh, these are suspicious and poisonous to like, oh, this is animal food and, you know, it's gross. And then eventually once you practice what to do with it and select the best varieties, it becomes, you know, a delicacy, something that you look forward to, but it takes time.
Yeah, it takes time to get to know a crop. And then also there's like this weird thing of food trends, which I think is interesting. But yeah, I mean, I also really started ramping up my seed production right at the time of COVID. So there the challenge was having, and like you couldn't grow enough seed.
Yeah, I had exactly the same experience. And then after COVID died down, nobody was interested in my seed anymore. They went back to the glossy packets, which made me a little bit bitter.
Yeah, for sure. But maybe hopefully they'll realize after a couple of years that, oh, but those local seeds I got actually did way better.
Yeah. I need to pull up my pants and have another try on that front. I actually just had a thought that potentially there's like a there's an economy of scale with the logistics of like testing and packaging and distributing seed. And if you're also trying to grow and breed, it's a big stretch to like do all of those other things successfully. And I almost wonder if breeders and growers who are at the end of their life cycle, when they lose the physical strength to do lots of outdoor farming, could be the right person to shift into that role in the community to become a like a seed coordinator to make sure that all the seed that is needed is being grown, to have a centralized facility that can check the quality and do all of the fiddly packaging and repackaging and distribution. That maybe that's a part of the community network that could get the balance right.
Totally, totally. I love that idea of working with people with where they're at, right? And kind of coming together and everybody just adding, you know, it's like a land race, like adding what they have to help the project thrive. It makes me, it brings to mind one of the growers that I've been working with as part of the seed collective here. And she is an older grower now. She's been saving so many varieties of seeds for almost 50 years. She's an incredible person, an incredible seed saver. And she recently, though, has gotten to this point where she's like, I don't have the energy nor the inclination anymore to maintain this, you know, regimented, every 3 years growing out one of my different three varieties of cabbage seed that I save. And she's growing on a smaller scale. She's got an acreage, but she's not, you know, she's not a production gardener. She doesn't have a farm. And she's just in the last few years, just letting all of her varieties cross. Which I thought was really interesting that after all of these years of keeping them separate, she has just decided, well, you all work here. You all work great. Just cross. I don't need to keep you separate. I don't need to maintain these rigid boundaries between you anymore. And yeah, I just thought that was a really beautiful thing that she was able to kind of just let go that way. And, but yet still keep all that diversity in her garden.
When you can manage to get a culture of growing a crop across a whole community, I think it makes sense to have like one diverse landrace variety of each type of crop, so you don't have all of these headaches about things crossing when you don't want them to. And yeah, provided that they're spread between lots of different gardens, you can have so much diversity in that one population that hangs around for a long time.
Yeah, have you worked on a project like that where, you know, a landrace population is being grown out in gardens, kind of in a community or several communities?
I'm at the very beginning of my journey of trying to build those networks in my community. Australia has a very dispersed population. Not many people do home production, home gardens, and we tend to be very disconnected from each other. So I've got my work cut out for me to try and reverse that. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm so interested in talking to people who've done it before in other settings, to get ideas about all the factors I need to try and consider and balance against each other.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep in touch because my thesis project kind of has spawned into another project kind of funded by the university, but with a number of community partners where we're growing out this watermelon landrace next year with the idea of raising awareness about landrace breeding, but also building capacity and teaching and sharing seed with the idea. So kind of think of bringing people together to see these watermelons, interact with them, knock on them, try to figure out if they're ripe, harvest them, taste them, make selections, take seeds, and go to their gardens in this wide geographic region we call Northwestern Ontario and grow them. And then come back. And like you said, share them and just build, see what can happen, see how we can build a network and see if landrace can have whether it's watermelon or squash or another crop, but watermelon's what we have to work with right now. See if they what kind of role that can play in kind of our the food sovereignty of this region,
Yeah.
basically.
I really love the potential of collaborative tasting events that were mentioned some of the growers did in the thesis, and Joseph's done them as well, I think, with his tomato population. And particularly for crops like watermelon, where the tasting and the selection can happen at the same time. Have you got any
Yeah.
more thoughts about how that could be rolled out into a community setting?
I mean, I think it's pretty, yeah, I mean, I have lots of ideas of various ways we could have tastings. We had a seed saving event kind of related to this project I was just describing a couple weeks ago. And we did a bunch of teaching around, you know, saving carrots, overwintering them as a biennial crop and different types of things. And then we had a little lunch break, and to start the lunch break, we cut open and tasted and selected seed from probably 20 different watermelons. And so it, yeah, and folks were invited to take seeds of anything that they loved. And I think, I mean, with watermelon, it just makes it makes it so easy to do. I think it would be really lovely. I think the neatest part in my mind, the dream, the ideal is like getting people into the field and harvesting the melons as well. And like nitty-gritty logistics of that, I haven't really thought through yet. But if we talk again this time next year, hopefully, you know, I will have made it happen.
I wonder if the criteria of early ripening could be used as like a town hall event set on a particular day, chosen when like the first, 10, 20% of the melons would be ripe. So people bring along those early ripening fruit to have a collective tasting ceremony, competition.
Oh, because you're thinking of fruit from diverse places.
Well, they at least need to be close enough to get to a central location. You don't want people having to drive too far.
Oh, yeah,
But
but you're
yeah.
thinking of things that folks are growing in their yards versus things. Sorry, I've got my brain wrapped around
Oh,
things, you know, a
production.
population grown in one central place.
No. Yeah, this would be a competition, like in the local area, that the melon festival will be on this particular day, and if you can grow a ripe fruit by that day, you can enter it in the competition, and everyone will get a taste, and everyone votes on the melon that they love the most, and that becomes like the elite melon that gets redistributed the next year.
I think that would be really fun. Although you would still want to make sure that you had different
Some
seeds in the
diversity.
population.
You wouldn't want to make it too narrow. But I mean, you could do the same thing with like pumpkins as a storage crop, that you would do it as late as possible, that like most of the pumpkins would have rotted or deteriorated by that point, and then you have a tasting festival for the ones that have stored the most successfully.
Totally. I like the idea of a tasting festival. We've also done this with tomatoes, where we've invited folks in the community to bring in their favorite tomatoes and we'll show them how to save the seeds. And then we can all share and taste each other's tomatoes. And then it's a great chance to share seeds right there because you know you love this tomato, you just tasted it. So I think bringing people together to do that kind of thing is really, yeah, it's really valuable. It's really neat. It builds great connections and it brings together all sorts of diversity.
I had one other thought for community-based breeding projects, is the idea of the network structure and the resilience or the fragility, because often you end up with one person at the middle of the network, like kind of spearheading or driving the project with all of these like huge number of connections outwards. But if that one person, drops out of that activity or they get sick or move away, the whole network can like disappear overnight. It's a very fragile system. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how to build resilient networks where there's like quality connections throughout the network, and it's capable of dealing with people changing their involvement over time.
Yeah, I mean, the thought that comes to mind is just that, in my experience at least, having organizations play that kind of central person role is has been so valuable. You know, without the EFAO and this farmer-led like kind of being the touchstone and facilitating and supporting this farmer-led research project, I'm not sure it would have coalesced and kind of stayed together in the same way that it has over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I personally, I mean, I am invested in it and excited about it, so I probably would have made the point of being the one to reach out to people and check in and, you know, do all that stuff. But it's been lovely being able to be excited and motivated and invested in the project, but not burnt out from taking on all that extra responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the same thing I found, you know, I've taken part in a number of kind of national variety trials that happen on kind of a larger scale than what I've been talking about with this kind of collaborative breeding project. So I don't know any of the other farmers, or know that I know any of the other farmers doing these variety trials. But they've still been really neat to be a part of. And again, those are facilitated and kind of maintained and managed by different organizations. And
you mentioned Seed Linked as a Canadian organization, or at least a source of data.
It's a website developed. I believe the developer is American, but it's been used as kind of the platform for where we record our data and upload our photos from some of these variety trials that I've done. And so I'm working on one right now that's part of some work being done at Cornell University. Other ones I've done have been through in partnership with the EFAO and the Bauta Family Initiative on Seed Security. So there's all sorts of different organizations that use this platform. And yeah, it's been a really neat place to go. You upload kind of your various observations as required for the variety trial, but you can also see what other trials are being taken, have taken place, and what other folks are finding. And it's just a neat repository of information around this kind of stuff that's hard to find otherwise.
You've got me thinking this Seed Linked is more directed towards like market gardeners and producers by the look of it.
But you can buy, I believe you can like, they have seed available through there too, or variety descriptions of varieties of seed. I've never tried to buy seed through there, but I feel like there's a portion of the page where there's, you know, they're talking about very specific varieties of seed.
Mm. I'm going to have a look into that, because I would love to see if it could be adapted for like backyard growers, like home growers.
I don't see why home growers could not use
Seed Linked already. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like why that platform wouldn't be kind of appropriate or available to a similar project that takes place on a smaller scale than it maybe would in a production garden.
And again, this is my awful tendency to reinvent the wheel and want to do everything on my own from scratch. And it's like, look for things that have already been built and then repurpose them. It's like the watermelons, like the elephants have already done 90% of the work. You're just doing a little bit on top.
Yeah, totally. Totally. A lot of work has been done out there.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure.
So wrapping up questions, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
Yeah, this is a great question. I would love for my community, and when I say that, I mean my immediate community, but also the region more broadly, to be more food and seed sovereign. And I see that happening. I don't have like a, I can't kind of close my eyes and see all the various steps that need to be taken to get there. But I do think that when it is there, things are going to look webbier.
Mm.
Like there's going to be more connections. There's going to be more collaboration. And I mean that between people and between organizations, but also I think more intentionally collaborating and thinking of it as collaboration with plants and with pollinators and with soils. And so kind of maybe what I'm talking about more is like a perspective shift than any sort of tangible, visible thing, but that where I want it to be is one where we make room for that agency that non-humans have and can relate to the world in a way that gives it, that's just more caring and gives it space to be who it is instead of trying to dominate.
Mm. No, I love that answer. How can people learn more about your work and maybe get in touch?
Yeah, well, probably the easiest way to get in touch with me would be through my farm website, Do you have show notes, Shane? Like, is
I
it?
will. I will. Yep.
Yeah.
I'll
Okay.
put all
So
the
maybe
links in the
I
show
can.
notes.
Yeah, I'll give you all this information for the show notes. So yeah, to get in touch with me, you can email me through my website, and I managed to update it every winter, which feels like a lot to me, but is not a lot, I know. But that also, if you're looking early in the new year, is probably the best way to find out most up to date what I'm up to. I also mentioned this project that I'm doing with the university, and that you can find out more about through the Lakehead University Sustainable Food Systems Lab, which I can also give you the website for, Shane.
Excellent. Excellent.
I don't really do the social media thing, although I am on the Going to Seed kind of community.
Oh, the Discourse forum.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a wonderful resource.
There is so much happening on there. And again, I always forget to check in, but I am there. So there's another way to get a hold of me if you don't mind waiting for me like for a month before I realize there's a message.
And what is your final message for people thinking of getting into local agriculture?
That's a good one. I think I would just say to remember that when we work with plants, we're engaged in like a mutually effective relationship with them. And we're changing each other and we're being changed by each other. And I think that I would kind of want people to remember this because this inspires, I think, a really deep curiosity and reciprocity and openness that can allow for the reimagining of how our food systems can look more broadly and how diverse beings on this planet can relate. So it creates a kind of this lovely, I think, emergent space where new realities can happen between plants and people. And I think that's one of the most exciting things we can grow.
Can I be very selfish and drop a little thing that that made me think of?
Yes, of
So,
course.
growing up, I never had pet dogs and I was never a dog person. And late in life, I got my first dog. I love my dog to bits. I'm still not a dog person, but I'm a my dog person. And I think there's something similar to like if you just buy vegetables at the supermarket or just grow seedlings that you get at like the big commercial nurseries, it doesn't really mean anything. But if you breed your own locally adapted variety, it becomes like a pet. It becomes something that you have a personal bond with. Like I've got my first Landrace crops that I've bred that I've had for years now. I couldn't imagine being without them. Like they're such an important part of my life and my routines. And we take care of each other in so many ways. And I think that's something people who, even if they've grown vegetables before, haven't done any of their own breeding or adaptation, may not realize that there's that potential to actually feel that affectionate about a lineage of something that you've grown for years.
It brings to mind something that somebody said to me when I was chatting with them for my thesis about this idea that growing and working with this landrace of watermelons allowed them sort of the freedom to get away from this sort of market garden yield production, this carrot doesn't look good enough kind of way of thinking that I think is really easy to get into. I know it's a place that I've gotten trapped in the past. And really, inspired instead this sort of like you're just an acceptance of the diversity of the melons. I mean, Landrace is all about diversity, but just also just accepting plants and being curious about plants for who they are and why they are and what they're doing.
On that lovely note, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. And maybe we'll check in again in the future and see how things are going.
Shane, it's been lovely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, take
Bye.
care.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use. since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.